This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Peter Payette. A couple years ago, Doug Stanton was in a bookstore in Dallas when he realized something was not right in the business of books. His account of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, Horse Soldiers, was a bestseller, but the crowd at the bookstore was tiny. Doug decided something needed to be done about this, and the result was quite extraordinary. He started his own writer series and throughout 2010 regularly drew hundreds of people to the Traverse City Opera House to listen to authors of all stripes talk about their work. The 2011 schedule for the National Writer Series was just released this week, and Doug Stanton joins me this morning on Points North to talk about elevating authors and the business of letters. Good morning, Doug.
Hi, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. So, tell us what happened to you that day in Dallas.
That sounds like a loaded question. Horse Soldiers was selling thousands of books a week. I'd just been on Today Show and Morning Joe, and which I'd done with In Harm's Way as well. Lots of national media. And so that's and I was doing lots of radio interviews. In that moment in Dallas, I asked the bookseller. It was a chain bookstore, and this we can go to a larger question about this business model. But I said to the person, "How many things are for sale in this store?" And she said, "About 600,000 different items are for sale in the store." It was as big as a parking garage, and it was a Thursday night, and it was raining in Dallas, and there weren't people circulating through to really. In fact, there was really no one in the store really buying stuff. It just seemed like it was a part of town that wasn't moving a lot and wasn't filled with energy. This is very different than what happened with my first book, In Harm's Way, where regularly in the chains again, and some of the great independents across the country, there'd be a lot of people every night showing up to interface with an author, so to speak, in a bookstore. What I realized is that because I was sitting in the hotel room in Dallas, and the publisher had paid about $2,500 to send me to that city, and that's about what it costs to go to each city, they had booked me on about 8 or 9 radio interviews that day with satellite places across the country. And I asked the publicist, "How many people am I speaking to?" And she said, "About 28 million. So while they were still spending the money on the old digital model, or the analog model, but in reality, the way authors and the way we were reaching people was actually very digital and a lot more computer savvy. So I was actually talking to lots of people, but I was doing it on my cell phone in my hotel room that they had booked, and then going to the chain bookstore, which is what had worked very well in 2001 to 2003 and even 2004. And before the internet really exploded, before this idea of satellite booking of radio interviews had come up. So it was just, it was a funny confluence of events.
And so this was of great concern to you, or became of great concern to you, and I'm wondering why, if you are still able to reach a large audience and sell your books, and hopefully people who buy them read them, what does it matter if the people are not coming into the bookstore locally to meet you?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we talked about that. I think I just spent so long writing Horse Soldiers that I thought this is what it ended up. I mean, I seemed to be selling a lot of books. I spent about 5 or 6 months in the New York Times list with that book. It got to number 2, I think. So I was actually – it had paid off in some way. But it seemed that the experience of the tour just – wasn't as robust as it had been within Harm's Way. Typically, there'd be 200-300 people in every bookstore that I went to, and you'd sell about 100 books a night, and you'd do lots and lots of media on all these different TV and radio affiliates. That also, I noticed, and I talked to James Bradley about this, one of our series guests this last year, had evaporated. So, but to go back to the question of why it matters because an author principally wants to sell books and meet his readers or her readers. I mean, we could live in this universe where it's very bifurcated and balkanized like iTunes, where you really only never, you know, that's all, and everything kind of comes to you in bytes and kilobytes. But the reality is, I think, that storytelling is about being in a room with other people and hearing that story being told. And what we're doing at the National Writers Series is creating these very intimate moments, and we are capturing them on video and audio. And we're finding that publishers are saying, "We'd like to use this to push it further down the road for our authors on their book tours, because when they go to Dallas, for everybody, no one is really showing up at the chain bookstores anymore. And there aren't many great independents in that store to begin with, in that city. And the affiliates, like the ABC affiliate in the morning, doesn't have anybody anymore to book authors on. So it's a very different landscape for authors.
So they're the people trying to sell the books, the marketers, are saying then if they're taking video and audio of these events, mm-hmm. that there is some value, that people do want to hear the voice of the author or watch them speak, even if they're not in the room. But you're, what I hear you saying is that for the author, there's some kind of value in looking people face to face and engaging with them.
There is that value, but the other thing I discovered, Peter, and let me give you a very quick thumbnail sketch. When I first published In Harm's Way about World War II, I remember standing in the O'Hare Airport. It's like 7 o'clock in the morning, and doing a phoner interview with an AM station in St. Louis, where I was flying to later that day. So I'm actually in the ticket line doing this radio interview. I land in St. Louis, then I rush off to the ABC Good Morning St. Louis on ABC, which is a small TV affiliate. Then you do Good Afternoon St. Louis on the CBS affiliate. And then if you're lucky, you do Good Evening St. Louis on the NBC affiliate around the 5 o'clock hour. In the meantime, you do an NPR interview, say mid-morning in that city. You do drop-in signings at independents and chain bookstores around the city. And then your evening event and book signing, and then you go to bed. There's a book escort who takes you around at a Hampton Inn. You get up and you fly to the next city, and you just keep doing this over and over and over. I did it in 50 cities. But every single city, there was this tons of media that you were creating, and that's what's selling books. No one's going to buy the book if they don't know about it. I'm not exaggerating. That stuff is all gone. I mean, those small affiliates no longer have people employed who can book authors to come on the show. When you walk into the studios, the cameras are run by robots now, and there's someone there's a very nice person in a booth running it with a joystick. And so what I said, this is what's missing. So what's replaced it is this radio. In fact, my publisher had subcontracted this radio booking out to another firm in Virginia, which does it very well for lots of authors who sell a lot of books. So they'd paid them to actually book all the radio. This is so totally different than the way the book biz used to be. So I said, in Traverse City, since we're a regional media market, we can do all this stuff that used to happen. And publishers will find it valuable, and authors will be pleasantly surprised and pleased to be able to do all this stuff. So when an author comes to town, they do an amazing amount of this is kind of essentially media that they don't find anywhere else in the country.
And the reception, I would admit, was surprisingly good from my viewpoint. I was, obviously, when you have someone like Tom Brokaw come to Traverse City, you can fill the Opera House. But there were quite substantial crowds for authors that probably a lot of people have not heard of.
Well, the National Writers Series in some ways is a writer employee program, because what. It's my fervent belief that everyone deserves a book tour, and everyone who writes a book deserves a reader. And they're out there. I know they are. Give me a book about plumbing, and we can sell that book. I would go to every plumbing shop and every remodeler and every rebuilder and every engineer in the county or in the city in this northern Michigan. I'd say, we have this amazing book about plumbing. You're not going to believe it. Come, and they will show up. So what you do is you take the unfortunate fact that we've all kind of balkanized ourselves into our likes and dislikes, and you exploit that, and you go out and you just sell to the people who are going to show up. That model in that chain bookstore in Dallas was more like the swimming pool filter model. You know, you've got the swimming pool, and stuff just kind of filters through, and once in a while it gets caught in the filter. And that's the old days, and they set up. But really, if you really think about the way things are sold to you now, it's much more targeted and concerted. And Rhoda Jansen came up here. So we had a huge crowd for Rhoda Jansen, whose book had been out for quite a while. But we went out and really said to people, if you're interested in spirituality, if you love humor, if you like, quote, women's issues, you'll like this book. And she had a huge crowd. She sold 200 plus books. And she had just a great time. And we want to do that for everybody. And we're doing that with, we have two kinds of other events that aren't Brokaw-like events in the series.
And what is it, in some places in the literature I see your hopes for what the bookstores would do, and you refer to, I think, New York Times registered bookstores. Or what is it you're hoping for from the bookstores?
Well, we want, there a couple of things. Northern Michigan has 5 to 8 great independent bookstores. It's a very unusual area, and I want to go through those in just a minute. But we get one call the day after events, and the call is this, and it's from New York, and it's from a publisher. How many people and how many books did you sell, and was it to a New York Times reporting bookstore? Because in the analog world of, say, pre-2005, you would do St. Louis, Chicago, Dallas, Seattle, Elliott Bay in Seattle, Powell's in Portland, Vroman's in L.A., Books and Books down in Florida, Vero Beach. I mean, I could name all Davis Kidd in the lower Midwest, all the great books. And you literally would go from bookstore to bookstore to city as fast as you could. And they would report, and you would sell, say, 100 books. 50 books, 200 books, and they press send the next morning on a report, and it goes to the New York Times, and you begin to appear on the bestseller list if you're in fact selling books. If you're not selling to a New York Times reporting store, you don't end up on the New York Times list. So, and all authors in some fashion feel that it's important to be on the Times list because they would like to write their next book. And when they go in with their agent and their publisher, and they literally say, "We're going to give you less money because you didn't sell as many books as you did the last time." I mean, this is a game of numbers in some way. You hear Peter Matheson, one of our great guests from the last series, talk about he had this amazing review of The Snow Leopard, really one of the towering achievements of 20th century literature, about his trek through the Himalayas. He got a great review in the New York Times, and I think he even said he thought it was going to be on the front page of the Sunday Book Review. There was the newspaper strike that week. The review never appeared. This is some 30-odd years later, and he's still lamenting that fact that he never got that review in the Times. So in some ways, so that goes to that question of the Times reporting store.
Right, and this goes to the point of having a full-service author event, even right down to encouraging the book sales the day after so they get the numbers that satisfy the agents and in turn help bring more authors to Traverse City.
Yeah, the thing about the National Writer, we're authors promoting other authors. And it's a very different take, and I think it's been a novel idea for New York when I call them to send us these authors because it's unusual for an author to be involved. My editor at Scribner, Colin Harrison, an author himself, a former editor at Harper's Magazine, said, "Doug, I don't know if it's a good idea that you know so much about this," because it is, however, I find it to be a fascinating business because book sales are booming. There was USA Today 2 days ago just did a fascinating report. You know, when the movie business is somewhat in the tank, and the music business is certainly in the tank, books are selling, and people are buying books, and they're reading. And I don't see why we can't have a book in everyone's hand on Front Street in Traverse City and in every Main Street, and it becomes as ubiquitous as watching Netflix. Because, in fact, reading is kind of the one thing. Everyone reads. Not everyone listens to music or watches a movie or reads a magazine even, but everyone in some way uses their eyeballs to kind of enter into another world. And I think part of the series is meant to kind of celebrate that fact.
I'm talking with Doug Stanton. He is the founder of the National Writers Series and is also an author who lives in Traverse City. The National Writers Series just announced its 2011 schedule. It'll open in early February with an evening with the writers of Mad Men, which is one of the most celebrated television shows made in recent memory. You could join in our conversation at 276-5200. We're joined now by Alan Shoes. He's a novelist, and he also reviews books for National Public Radio. He's a board member of the National Writer Series and will appear at an event this fall. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Doug.
Hi, Alan.
Thanks for joining us.
So it's a pleasure.
Doug was just explaining that books are selling very well, but he thinks it's a real problem that authors seem to have less and less opportunity to meet with their readers. What do you think about that?
Well, it's one of the loneliest businesses on earth is, you know, the writing of fiction and poetry and nonfiction. Although I think nonfiction can be more gregarious if you pick a public subject, whereas, you know, Yeats says, we go down in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. It's lonely down there. And so to get out and find an audience and meet an audience is a kind of thrilling thing for me. Doug is doing a great job at making this happen for a few authors every year. I think Obama should appoint him as book czar, and so he could make this happen all over America. I think, you know, whenever I have a book out there, I think if I could only meet, 5 million people and tell them about my book, you know, I could make a bestseller happen. You know, writers will occasionally sit on an airplane next to someone who says, what do you do? The dreaded question. And if you reveal to them that they can see what you do if they look you up on Amazon, they sometimes buy the book. If you could do that to 5 million people, you'd be in great shape. What Doug does is bring the writers to a willing and interested audience, and apparently they're buying a lot of books. So, Doug, can you do this all over America in every town and hamlet?
Yes.
but hold on here, Alan.
You will answer if called.
Yes.
The question, though, if you could sell those 5 million books, you know, over Facebook and radio interviews in remote mm-hmm. places where you are not present, are you still missing something if you don't get to show up at the Borders Books and meet 100 people?
Well, yeah. What's missing is the celebratory occasion where the maker of the words meets the reader of the words, and I think it's a wonderful thing when that happens. Those of us who teach writing workshops, either full time or part time, get to enjoy that when we meet our students and talk about not just our work, but the work of many other people and the students' work. I mean, it's really celebratory, kind of like a you know, an old master-apprentice relationship from the early Renaissance where, you know, towards the end of the day, everybody has a little bit of beer or wine after the hard work is done and they celebrate what they've done. I mean, that's the spirit of readers meeting writers and writers meeting readers. And I think this is, you know, what Doug seems to have done in Traverse City. Other people have done it from time to time, and I hope this series goes on for a long, long time. But there, as Doug was describing, this has evolved out of the collapse or the beginning of the collapse of the system that brings books to readers or brings writers to readers. And he's doing his job, a great job, to keep this going. But, you know, in the great unfolding of time, who knows how long anything will last like this. I mean, there's a tradition for this, as I see it. You know, if you let me just describe it, what I see. You know, he's got an opera house, a 19th century opera house, and bringing great, serious entertainment to people away from either of the ocean coasts. And this is how American culture thrived in the 19th century. Operas, great artists came by train or wagon and sang in these opera houses. Now he's got writers coming to sing in these in this opera house again. Particularly the Midwest location, you know, is kind of thrilling for any writer to want to walk into because, you know, out of the Midwest, we got Sherwood Anderson and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. So there's a great tradition already embedded in this part of the world. And for a writer from anywhere else to come there, I think is a kind of individual thrill for the artist. In a way, the writer who comes to Traverse City is shaking hands with young Hemingway.
Let's bring in a caller, Eric in Traverse City. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Good morning, Eric. Thanks for having me. Good morning, Doug.
Hi.
I'll bring this in only because I think it's somewhat relevant, but I make these portraits out of pushpins and have enjoyed that turning into a career for myself over the last year. And I read a manuscript from a friend of mine that was the most moving thing that I had read in I can't remember how long. And so, emboldened by what turned out to be sort of a quick rise for me through the artistic ranks, I thought, let's publish this book. We'll self-publish, and why can't this work, and this caliber is so strong. But I've been a bit vexed and flummoxed over the past year at coming to realize, as I did with my career, that the caliber of the writing was just one factor that was going to be equated. And so I wondered, Doug, if you could speak toward that fact, and how has that landscape changed, and what does an author need to have, in the way of a champion, mm-hmm. in addition to being talented?
Yeah, it's I get this question a lot. My phone rings and I answer it, and there's usually an author at the other end. And here's what I can say to you. I'm all about nuts and bolts and having real world kind of solutions to this question. I would ask you, what is the book like? And go to one of our great bookstores in the area. Go to Horizon in Traverse City, or Brilliant Books in Sutton's Bay, or McLean and Eakin in Petoskey, or Saturn Books over in Gaylord, etc. We got tons of them here. You look at the bookshelf and you imagine where your book would be if it were published, because around it will be other books like it. And you then go to the acknowledgments page. This is very mercenary. And you see the author always thanks their agent and their editor. And you then write them a letter and you call them. And then you say, by the way, I'm going to be in New York next week. Do you mind if I just stop by and drop off my manuscript? You get very proactive about this. But one of the things that writers never really are taught to think about is how they actually are going to kind of manage their life. Because at one level, this is about groceries as much as it is about, as Alan says, the ragged, the Yeats anecdote that he gave us. So we can talk further off the air. I know you live in the area, but if you'd like to call me, I'd actually be glad to talk to you about this.
I'd love to do that, and thanks for those pointers.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Eric. And let's bring in now, because we've had waiting on the line, Debbie Seeger. She's the Vice President of Marketing and Publicity at Grove Atlantic Press at the end of the 2010 National Writers Series. Grove brought Carl Melantes here. He's the author of Matterhorn. Good morning, Deb.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. So hi, Doug. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Good morning.
I don't know if you heard the caller, but he was saying he's an artist and has had some success and was feeling that merit was only one factor in helping his friend publish his manuscript. What would you say to that?
You know, it's a difficult landscape out there. There is so many books being published every month and every year that, you know, it's hard to rise to, you know, to the top. You know, coming from a publishing house, I think that, you know, a lot of the media kind of looks to the publishers to say, you know, what is good, it's a little bit difficult for self-published to rise. That's not to say that it doesn't happen. It happens a few times, but, you know, it's working with the media, it's having an author that's willing to go out on the road, an author who's a willing participant in helping market and publicize themselves. It's kind of a group effort, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of people to make a book work out there, and luck.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's all about luck.
Yeah, and also, Deb, you're being modest because, you know, Peter, Alan knows this, but Deb Seeger is one of the hardest working publicists in publishing, and she took Carl Melantes' book Matterhorn. And Deb, wasn't that in some ways it was published by a small press first, wasn't it?
It was. It was published by a nonprofit publishing house in Berkeley, California, called El Leon Literary Arts, a small house out there that had taken on Carl's book, and they had sent it to Barnes & Noble, the Discover program at Barnes & Noble, for new writing, and they fell in love with it. But, you know, El Leon was in a tough situation. They, you know, would they be able to produce enough books? Could they have that, you know, they were going to publish 1,200 copies of the book.
1,200.
So we all got together, Morgan Entrekin, my boss, the publisher of Grove Atlantic, and Tom Farber over at El Leon got together and worked out a co-venture deal so we could co-publish this book, and we were able to bring it further out into the market. You know, El Leone, Kit Duane, who was the editor, the original editor of this book, did a great job, but they needed kind of an extra push to get it out there, to have it in every, you know, all the bookstores around the country, Barnes & Noble, Barnes & Borders, the Independents, everybody, and really we kind of helped push that along.
Let me jump in. So, Deb, let me bring you back to the sort of initial point that Alan and Doug and I were discussing, and that is that the National Writer Series is about this kind of intimate connection between writers and readers. What is the value of that from a marketing perspective?
Well, I think what Doug is doing, you know, there is fantastic. You bring an author there, and you know right off that author is going to be taken care of. They're going to be picked up from the airport. They're going to be taken to dinners, there's going to be media around that, you know. And then to top it all off, you're going to go to this great opera house, and you're going to have a packed audience. Carl Milantes, who's a debut novelist, you know, had 500 people awaiting him at the event. So it's a mixture of everything. It's someone, so you know, you're going to send an author who's going to be comfortable, welcomed, and is going to be able to reach beyond the 500 people that were at the event. But because of the media reach, is going to be able to get even further out to an area of the country that we may not have been able to penetrate before that.
Now, Alan, let me come back to you. You made a reference earlier to the beginning of the collapse of the system by which books get from the pen into the reader's hand. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I think it's an era of constantly destructive and creative transition at the same time. Doug started talking a little bit about that. And Deb, I think you'll probably second this. The old way of, you know, getting bookstores to order the books and bringing writers into the stores is really quite up in the air. I think there was a kind of overproduction of readings for a while. Deb, would you agree?
I would agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, every bookstore in, you know, most cities in America has an event every night, or used to have an event every night, and there was a kind of customer fatigue set in. Is that a fair way to describe it, do you think?
I would say that's true. I mean, I remember when the readings started, when the author readings began,
mm-hmm,
about
right.
15 years ago, and it was a mm-hmm. great, it was such a rare event to come see an author speak, and now it's become, you know, there are some stores that will have two events a day,
yes.
You know, and it's there's too much, and there's so much else going on that people are being, you know, media, different forms of entertainment.
Right. So I think Doug started to describe this, you know, so sometimes when you go out on the road, you'll have, you know, you'll go to Powell's in Portland, and there'll be 100 people. We're 200 people, and then you'll go to a bookstore in, you know, just say Houston or St. Louis, and there'll be four people. So a lot of things go into the making of a good crowd or don't get done so that there's not much of a crowd. And this, the system is very, very awkward and basically, as you say, requires a lot of luck for things to click. The internet, which a lot of people think is a kind of beast, I think is helping to fill in some of these lacks right now. It may well be that we'll have a system where everybody can meet Gore Vidal by tuning in on a website, you know, in a certain time and day. I don't know if you've tried that at Atlantic yet with some of your writers, but I mean, you get Sherman Alexie to be on a website at, say, midnight on Saturday night. People would tune in, don't you think?
I think they would definitely tune in, and it'd be a great form of free entertainment. I don't know, in the end, what we're, you know, and it's great to reach out and meet new writers, but are you going to be able to sell your books?
Isn't it word of mouth that
it is
drives
word of mouth.
Things?
Yeah.
Built, I mean, it's the foundation of everything.
Yeah.
I think the internet can encourage word of mouth. I mean, what Doug does is, you know, have 100 or 200 or 300 people in that in that opera house means that they will each speak to one or two people about what they've heard and what they are reading, and that word will spread that way.
What we say here, it's always one book at a time.
Yes, right. I was saying earlier, I don't know if you were listening earlier, but I say if you could meet 5 million people face-to-face with every new book, you'd be in great shape.
Yeah, and Alan, those 5 million, those readers are out there, and I think that's mm-hmm. what we'll be figure out here in the next 5 to 7 years. I mean, I thought that we could, I thought if I had all world enough and time, we could do what we're doing in Traverse City in 5 to 7 other cities across the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a very funny story, and I got this idea on my last book tour, which was lots and lots of cities, and the cookbook authors always had the biggest events. Mm-hmm. And the book I would always kind of debrief the book escort, who's usually a retired teacher hired on a freelance basis to pick me up at the airport, and they know everything: what's selling, who's the good bookstore, whatever. And I said, so who really is having the biggest crowds? And mm-hmm. the cookbook authors, and that's because they bring in food, and they bring in pots and pans, and they bring in wine. And
that happens at the Miami Book Fair all the time.
Yeah.
You want to see the big crowds go over to the cooking demonstration.
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly. Sam Tannehouse is talking at the main dais, and then he has a huge crowd too. But I said, so this is interesting. This is not about giving. This is not school. This is actually, you're entertaining the audience. That translates into book sale. And that's the whole point of going on the road, because after 9 salad bars at Hampton Inns in the 49th city, you think, if I'm not selling books, they're going to take me off the road. I don't know if people really get this about what a writer's life is like, but you spend months and months writing a book, and then you go out and you do want to meet people. It goes back to Peter's point about the intimacy. So what we do is really not even an interview or a reading. It's really just, when I pick up the author at the airport, I just think, now we're driving around the whole day doing interesting things. We're taking a walk along the beach in Lake Michigan. And then for a certain amount of time, we're going to be in public on the stage at the Opera House. And we don't have to talk about anything in particular, but it just has to be real and warm and intimate in some way and small.
Which on the part of a lot of writers requires a certain amount of theater, or let's say it, acting.
Yeah,
I think a lot of writers become disappointed in their road tours because they don't see that they're expected by an audience to perform in a certain way. I think, you know, writers who teach workshops have a leg up on writers who are completely solitary, in that, you know, teachers have to perform every time they walk in front of a classroom. And an event like a reading or a conversation on stage is a performance. And it's, you know, if writers don't realize that when they go out on the road, they're going to be very disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me jump in. We have a caller, and let me tell listeners, you can join in at 276-5200. Jack in Traverse City, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, thank you for this very interesting discussion. I'd just like to add one element of the National Writer Series that I've observed at the events, and that is the large number of young people, school children and young high school students, who are attending and meeting authors for the first time. And I was reminded of how different their world is when my daughter received a tweet during one of the events when another student from her same school tweeted everybody else saying, I just got to ask a question of Peter Matheson. That kind of raises, though, in my mind, well, how are we going to capture these young people who live in a world of one-minute sound bites? And I know that e-books is becoming the way my daughter is buying books. What effect does that have on the writer's world, on the writer's income, for that matter?
Deb, could you take that?
Well, it's a, you know, it's not my forte, but what it is is it's changing the way people think about the accessibility, or what it's changing the cost value of a book, and that's I think the biggest problem for authors and publishers, is that, you know, there's this idea that books should be $9.99 and that, you know, they're less expensive now, but, you know, it really, the only expense that's been taken out of that equation is the production, but you still need editors, you still need marketing. And so it's changing the price value, which is going to, in the end, hurt the authors, you know, what the publishers and authors can financially make. But it's a, you know, but it's also a completely new world, and we don't really know, and we're trying to figure it out now, how that's going to change the landscape. But I do think that there'll always be the, you know, maybe I'm living in a pipe dream, but there'll always be the book. You know, it may go back to the way books once were, where they were beautiful objects and there were limited numbers of hardcover books. But I think that the book will never die. But this ebook scenario is changing, and it's going to change the cost evaluation and how people, if they can make money in publishing, can make money.
Yeah. And Alan, we've got to say goodbye to Deb, and then I'll throw it to you. So, Debbie Seeger, thank you for joining us this morning. It was nice to talk with you.
Bye.
And she's the Vice President of Marketing and Publicity at Grove Atlantic Press. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. I'm still talking with Alan Shoes and Doug Stanton about the National Writer Series, but more generally about books and writing and trying to connect writers with readers, which is what the National Writer Series is about. The 2011 schedule has just been released. You can join in our conversation if you like at 276-5200. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I wrote an essay once. I tried to imagine what it would be like just speculating at the end of an essay on reading about a crew on some interstellar spaceship reading an electronic version of Moby Dick. This is long before I ever imagined anything like e-books, but I just figured, you know, in 100 years or 1,000 years, whenever we do those interstellar voyages, if we're lucky, that's how you'll get the book, and your library will be there in the computer. The Moby Dick will be the same text. The experience of reading it will be remarkably different. But that's the great thing about great books, is the text remains the same. The experience changes on the part of the reader.
How does it change?
Well, you know, it's a matter of aging. This is a good thing about aging. You read Moby Dick when you're 15, and then you read it at 35, and you read it at 55, and you read it at 75. You read different things into it. It's a way of playing it the way a great orchestra plays a symphony. There are different ways of interpreting certain sections. And I think, a great book becomes more magnificent the more a reader has experienced it. Life changes for the reader. The book technically remains the same, but a great work changes in the mind of the reader as the reader rereads. And that's the great thing about the books that endure. They become slightly different for every generation. And, that's one of the great things about any art form. It endures, but it endures in such a way as to enhance the particular experience of new generations, one after another. End of sermon.
did you have any thoughts on this, Doug?
Do you mind people how people read your books, Alan, digitally or on the page? I get asked this question a lot. What do you think of ebook?
And No, I don't mind. But as Deb points out, the writer makes less money with an ebook. But I was thinking as she was talking, why not? Maybe some great marketing guy or woman out there will say, "Well, wait a minute. What if we can lower the price of a book the more readers it has? So start at say $15. I mean, that $9.99, I think, is there because one of the companies has had the only marketing device for sending out ebooks. But now then there's a lot more competition, so prices will fluctuate. But what if you say the price to the reader goes down if that person can, you know, by word of mouth, bring in 5 more readers? And a book that sells, 5 million copies will be cheaper than the one that sells 4,000 copies. I mean, in a way, the kind of the reverse of royalties. You know, royalties increase the more books you sell. And maybe the more books you sell could mean the reader will pay less. I don't know how this... At the moment, ebooks mean less money for a writer. But presumably a larger audience.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're joined now by Janet Leahy. She is a television writer. She currently writes and produces the show Mad Men, and she will appear. She'll be one of the first guests at the National Writer Series in early February. She joins us from her home in California, I think. Janet, good morning.
Hi, how are you guys?
Hi,
good morning,
Janet.
All
can
hail
you hear
to
me
you.
Okay?
We can. Thank you for joining us.
We worship
thanks
you.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking a lot about the kind of the landscape for writers of books and the challenges they face, the challenges connecting with their readers. You have been writing for television, as I understand it, going back to the Cosby Show, and maybe you could describe a little bit what the scene is like for script writers.
I can tell you for television writers, not for screenplay writers. For television writers, the landscape has changed enormously, but it's always changing. Television is always changing in some respects, and in other respects, it's not at all. You always have your law show or your medical show, et cetera. But in terms of the economy and how media has changed things for the writer, it has shrunk. The staff sizes have shrunk. Probably because television's become more like magazines, in that there's so many now, and that the money is just not there for particular shows. And now because of cable, you're able to do a little bit more. You get to have a little bit more originality in your work if you're lucky. Something like Mad Men is a good example of that. So there's a potential for greater artistry, so to speak. But on the other hand, salaries have gone down, staff sizes have gone down, so the writer's been asked to be more flexible.
And what is the effect on the writing itself when you have fewer people working around you on the show?
I can tell you my experience. I think it's fantastic, because I think that if you have a small staff of great writers, I experienced this on Gilmore Girls. I'd gone from doing 20 years of sitcoms to going to one-hour shows, and Gilmore Girls was my transition. And on that staff, we had about four writers, and they were excellent, and sometimes five. And at that point, it's just a small group discussion. There's no competition for a voice in the room. Sometimes when you get these large staffs, there'd be more competition for a voice in the room rather than focus on the material and the show. And so for me, I liked it a lot more. But it forces you to pick and choose your writers critically, because if you don't have four or five great writers, then you're going to be missing sort of a member of your team, so to speak.
It's interesting, Janet. You know, we're talking about really this is a discussion about finding your audience. How an author in this new media landscape is going to find his audience, her audience, and sell books and continue to make a living. Cabe, you know, you're working on one of the greatest shows on television, and in the old days, the cable to be on cable was not to find your audience; it was to really kind of be off in the hinterlands. That's totally changed now, hasn't it?
It hasn't. The audience is as much publicity as Mad Men gets, and as much of an audience we think it gets. It's very small compared, relatively speaking, compared to broadcast television, and we forget that. But its presence is so known, it's so out there because of the quality in Matt's work, Matt Weiner, who created it, that it's on its own market, so to speak. Does that make sense?
But does that mean it makes less money than the big network shows?
You'd have to ask the finances guys.
Right.
I can't tell you because I don't know how their DVD sales go. And I tend to stay out of that unless I'm running a show. Right now I'm consulting and as a writer and producer, so I couldn't answer that for you. But if you want my guess, I would say it's probably making less money on the front end of things, and I couldn't tell you how much money they make on the DVDs and international sales, because it's an international hit as well. So.
But what you've taught us writers, is that you know, it's possible to bring quality to television, which
yes.
nobody believed was true.
And reach a mass market
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, Matt took a big risk with that, and I'm speaking on his behalf, but he's a good friend. Mm-hmm. I think he'd be okay with that. He went from doing The Sopranos, which was a highly regarded show, we all know, and he had to find a home for this little quiet pilot he wrote on spec probably 10, 12 years ago. We knew each other back then. And in order to find that home, he went to AMC, which basically wasn't on the map before that. And the reason they were willing to take a risk for them, and they said this publicly, is because he had done The Sopranos. And they were looking, and they were willing to take that risk. So you have to give kudos to AMC, who took that risk, right?
Janet,
and then it allowed other people to take that risk because they said, oh, well, it worked with this show. So a lot of this business is follow the leader. We know that from just watching all the copycat shows that's gone on for generations.
Janet, let me ask the issue that Doug brings up again, and the idea of the National Writer Series connecting with audiences. Is that something that happens very much for someone who's writing for television? Because I would guess that the audiences are interested in connecting with the actors who are the stars of the show.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what the question is.
So I'm wondering how often you go out to a place like Traverse City and speak to an audience, and how interested people who watch a show are.
They'll show up. It happens. I don't know. I find myself in odd speaking engagements. I was speaking about Jews in Hollywood in November, and yes, primarily, of course, they're going to want to talk to the actors because those are the famous people and they're the celebrities. And by God, they put their necks out every single week. But I think when you're talking about a show of quality, people actually want to hear from the writers as well. When I was running Boston Legal, I was quickly put on a lot of panels speaking about the show. And I think that speaks to the storytelling. If you're telling a good story, people want to know who's telling the story. And while the actors are there telling it, vis-a-vis their instrument themselves, they want to know who's created these stories and how these stories have come about.
Yeah, I think that goes to Alan's point. What's so interesting about and so excited about having you come here, Janet, is that you bring great quality to a mass market. And I think what we're trying to do with the Writer Series is the same thing. Is someone walking off the main street in town here can come in and see Richard Ford, because it's my conviction that when my son comes home and says, what is this poem supposed to mean to me? And I say just to him, just read it and tell me what you feel. I mean, that's where you want to begin. And we've taken ourselves out of this equation about being able to understand literature. Now, television's different because we just experience it differently. But I'm really convinced that we can bring quality to a mass market.
Alan, expand a little bit. You said that these shows have showed us that you can there can be great writing for television. When did we see that first?
Well, if you look at the last, say, 40, 50 years, what would we hold up as quality? Rod Serling's productions. I mean, that was pretty good sort of B-grade science fiction. For me, I didn't start watching these shows seriously until The Sopranos. Maybe because I'm from Jersey, you know, but that's where it began for me, and I was absolutely astonished by the quality of that show. I just could not believe that I was watching a television show.
It's novelistic,
Yes,
and
exactly.
By the way, if I can speak to those kinds of shows, not having worked on Sopranos, of course, but if I can speak to that, that speaks to time and money, but specifically time. Network television, I've done a lot of network television. The pressure that you are under to produce a product every week is enormous. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it on any other form of medium. And to do it well is enormously tricky and takes an incredible amount of flexibility. These shows on cable where you're doing 13 episodes, not that there isn't a time pressure, because there is, but it's not nearly the same pressure that was on people to do 22, 24 episodes in a shorter amount of time or the same amount of time. So that speaks to giving the writer a little bit more space and time in between these 13 episodes where they can regenerate and come up with new ideas. So I think that speaks a lot to the change.
You make that very clear. And it brings, it allows the writer to be as great as he or she possibly can be, because they don't have to rush it,
yes,
the first
the
take.
And the team, it's still a very much yes. team sport.
Yes. Well, you know, writers are solitary, but they have a team of voices in their head. I think Joyce Carol Oates calls writing controlled schizophrenia. So we all, you know, one voice says, that's terrible. Another voice says, well, maybe it's not so bad. So you have those embodied in the people that you work with, those voices.
Yeah, I don't know which is better. What's nice about that is you go into a writer's room and immediately you get feedback. Not, by the way, not just on your writing, but on any question you have in life. It is the most fabulous thing you can imagine. What do you think about, you know, popcorn poppers? I don't know. Everyone's got an opinion, but you certainly get enormously great, intelligent feedback very quickly. So it's a lot of fun that way.
You've moved us to a new level of serious entertainment, I think, with those cable shows.
Jenna, what do you think you'll talk about when you get here? You and I have talked on privately, but you're going to do talk about a show and show some clips, and you're going to have your friend Lisa Albert.
Lisa Albert will be there. She has been on the show since its inception. Lisa Albert, Matt Weiner, and I go back probably a dozen years, and you'll find this over and over again in television, that writers, it's a very small community, and I say the quality writers tend to stick together, and they end up working again and again together. Lisa and I have worked on, I think, four shows, and we may have worked on five. I'm not sure. Not all our best work or not all the best shows, but we had a lot of laughs. But so Lisa will be here. I will be here. We will talk about how do you get a show from an idea stage to the page to the screen. And we'll show some clips from Mad Men as an example. And then we can bring in stories from our own lives about the psychology of how a room works, how team writing works. It's a very interesting psychology, and it's enormously fun at times and sometimes a little bit tricky. And then entertain any questions people have vis-a-vis Mad Men or any of the other series we've all worked on.
All right, and that's February 3rd, Doug?
February 3rd, she kicks off our new season.
Okay, and we barely talked about the new season, but I assume it's on your website at
nationalwriterseries.org.
Okay, Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Janet Leahy will be here in February. She is a writer and producer of the cable television show Mad Men. We've also been talking with Alan Shoes, who's a novelist. He also writes reviews of books for NPR, and he was in a studio at National Public Radio. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
Alan, come on out in February.
I'll try to get out there as soon as I can.
And Doug Stanton is an author in Traverse City and founded the National Writers Series. Thanks to Bob Allen and Jack Connors for helping me produce the show. John Wunsch composed and performed our theme music. This is Points North. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.